Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to New Books Network. I'm Galina Limorenko, doctoral candidate in neuroscience with a focus on biochemistry and molecular biology of neurodegenerative diseases at EPFL in Switzerland, and I will be your host today. Today we'll be talking to Michael Hanna about the new book, Extinctions, Living and Dying in the Margin of Error. Are we now entering a mass extinction event? Analysis of the fossil record suggests that we still have some time to avert the disaster, but we must act now. Well, Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So how are you? How's your weekend?
Oh, it's been an interesting weekend. There's been a neighbor whose pets have escaped and we've had to help them round it up this afternoon. But other than that, it's been just like any other Wellington weekend.
A bit of adventure there.
The temperature is miserable. It's got up as far as 10 degrees today, but at least the rain held off. We've had horrendous rain and wind over the last few weeks, and today it's been cloudy, but not too bad. We're getting fantastic sunsets, though. The Tongan volcano that blew up a few weeks ago, has pushed particles into the stratosphere, and the sunsets are absolutely gorgeous, the reds and oranges and pinks. It's beautiful.
Wow.
I'm going to miss them when the particles fall out of the stratosphere.
That is such an interesting sort of side effect of the eruption, isn't it?
It really is. My wife and I have been noticing these sunsets for a while, and then it didn't dawn on us that the reason we're getting them is this volcanic eruption.
So can you tell us, what do you do?
Well, I was a associate professor at Victoria University of Wellington here in Wellington, obviously. I've recently retired, but I'm still teaching part-time there for a while, and I still have some research projects to keep going. I started some with some colleagues in the Netherlands a couple of years ago, and I still have to finish that one off. So I'm still involved at the university, although officially I'm retired.
And what do you focus on in your field?
I'm what officially called a palynologist. That's a person who studies acids in soluble microfossils. So basically what we do is get a rock and we dissolve it in acids, a particular acid called hydrofluoric acid, and I look at the organic remains that come out of that. Largely it's spores and pollen, but the stuff I concentrate on is a group called the dinoflagellates, which are marine algae, or largely marine algae. And if you've ever seen those fantastic pictures of waves coming in at night and going bright blue due to bioluminescence, that's dinoflagellates that are responding to being disturbed, and they also cause a lot of the shellfish poisoning around the globe. But they're also really useful for determining past climates and past time. We can actually use them to date rocks, and I've done a lot of work on them through some drilling projects in Antarctica, which has just been a fantastic experience.
And what do you like about academia, and why did you choose it?
Why did I choose it? It's a really good question, because when I finished my doctorate, I went straight into industry. I actually worked for an oil company for 10 years until they decided they didn't want any palynology. But I've always had this hankering to be involved with academic projects. And I really, really love teaching. And I will miss that immensely as my retirement actually cuts in. The interactions with students and dealing with both undergraduate and postgraduate students, I've that just been a joy for my entire career in the university.
And what would you say to our student listeners and perhaps early career researchers?
What do I say? That's a hard one. for students, I think I don't know what is happening over in Switzerland, but our students have, because of the pandemic, have become almost divorced from the university. They're seeing it through Zoom or they're seeing it through videos, and they're not, I don't think they're getting the full university experience. And I would really encourage them to go back into the universities when they have a chance and mix with other students, mix with different people, mix with different groups. Expand their horizons, which is not, they're not getting the opportunity to do that anymore. For early academics, I have to feel sorry for them in many ways. I got the job and I had no research publications. Nowadays, the is so driven by publications that it's really difficult for them to actually get a position at a university. I know that a ex-PhD student of mine has done, she's got a really good position now, but she had to leave New Zealand to do it because there's just nothing available to her at all in New Zealand. And I found that really quite sad.
So your latest book is Extinctions, Living and Dying in the Margin of Error. So how did you go into writing it?
It's been an interesting journey. I had a friend who worked at Victoria many years ago, and we used to run joint courses together. He was in the philosophy department, I was in geology, but he is an extraordinary person. He knew more about biology and geology than a lot of people I knew, and we used to do joint courses on mass extinctions, and he said to me one day, you know, you really should write a book about these things. And it sort of hit me in the back of the head and it sat there for a while. But there are an awful lot of books about mass extinctions, about what caused each one of them. And they sort of work through them. And there are some very good ones. So I thought, no, that's not really a goer. That's not really going to be a possibility. So I still had this seed planted for writing a book. So my original plan was to write this enormous magnum opus discussing the entire history of diversity through time, from the earliest life through to the present day. And it became quite clear quite early on that this was too big a job for one person, and it would require a book about, you know, twice the size of War and Peace. But there's also a guy who worked with me from the Auckland University Press who kept saying, well, why would people want to read this? Why would people want to read that? And he made me trim it down and finally focus on what ended up in the book. And that, I guess I've been seriously writing it for two years before it's actually been published. But the interesting thing is, I've just retired from my position, and I've been going through all my old files and old notes, lecture notes, going back many, many years. And I realize now I've been writing this for 30 years. Mm-hmm. It's the stuff that's in there is reflected very much in the lectures I was giving when I first arrived. Yes, it's changed a lot. I mean, we the science has moved on enormously since then. But the ideas, the interconnectedness of things, which I hope comes through the book, are all there in my lectures that I was quite taken aback when I found that.
All right, so let's jump right in. So can we start with a very basic and easiest question, I suppose. What is a mass extinction event?
The definition I use is a significant drop in diversity in more than one major group over a wide geographic area that is relatively fast. No, no, not instantaneous, but fast. I think mass extinctions were first sort of brought into absolute focus by a couple of paleontologists called Raup and Stanley, who published a paper when they plotted all the level of extinctions against time. And what they found, two things. The first thing was, over time, it's actually become easier to survive on this planet. The rate of extinction has dropped from 500 million years ago to the present day. But superimposed on that, they found five really massive increases in extinction above the average background level. And they've become now known as the Big Five. Since then, I think a lot of people have been working on levels of extinction, and some people now recognize up to 19 major falls in biodiversity over the last 600 million years. So we shouldn't confine it to the five, although I use that term all the way through the book. I do flag quite clearly that there are more than five. It's just a nice, easy way of referring to them, big ones.
So what are some of the ways and approaches that you use, and also scientific techniques, to study the mass extinction events? Because presumably the species, they die all the time, don't they?
They do. And far better numerical paleontologists than I am have studied this. There are some, I think I review about three of them in the book, some really major advances being made in understanding the rate at which extinctions occur in the fossil record. And it's to do with the quality of the record improving once you hit 600 million years ago. It's to do with our ability to statistically analyze that record, and that's improving all the time. And they're really looking at the number of, not necessarily species, because that's hard to do, but higher level taxa, things like genera and families going extinct over a period of time. And of course, the latest iteration of that is that there's a Chinese group who have applied a supercomputer to the whole problem and have come up with what I think is an extraordinarily detailed patterns of diversity changes over the time. So it's a matter of looking at the number of these groups going extinct per unit time. It's to do with our statistical ability to analyze this data and to remove biases that are built into the record. And then finally, we're starting to apply supercomputing to the whole thing. And I think that's going to be, really is going to open up the field enormously.
Does that include all of our biomes, like terrestrial and aquatic?
That's also a very astute observation. The fossil record is biased, but it's biased in a very predictable way. We know that the majority of fossils that we find are marine and they're hard-bodied. So they're dominantly shellfish and material like that. We have very good records of terrestrial material, that's spores and pollen, vertebrates, dinosaurs, and that sort of stuff. But undoubtedly, these records are biased towards marine fossils. But I think we understand enough now of the terrestrial records to see these things working in parallel. It's a bias, but it's a bias we understand and can cope with.
So what is the earliest extinction event that we know of?
I have to think back now. It's the end Devonian. I have a thing about calling it a mass extinction, like the Cretaceous-Tertiary boundary. It slipped into the wrong terminology. This is a side issue, and I think it's a huge footnote in the book to cover it. It used to be called the Cretaceous-Tertiary boundary. That's when all the dinosaurs died, and it was colloquially known as the KT because they were the symbols for the two boundaries. But the powers that be have got rid of the tertiary. Now we have the Paleogene. So it's now the KPG, and I really hate that. So I always refer to them the end. So we're talking about end Devonian, end Ordovician, end Permian, end Jurassic, end Cretaceous. The end Ordovician is the first of the, the end Ordovician is the first of the big five, and then it's end Devonian, end Permian, end Jurassic, and end Cretaceous. And of course, the end Permian is the big one. That's we're looking at estimates up to about 96% of at least marine animals going extinct at any one time. And there are similar changes to on land, but it's a little harder to actually say exactly how many are going extinct there.
So what are some of the extinctions that really fascinate you?
There's two that fascinate me. One is, and I cover them in the book, one of them is the end Permian. Because it's so big, it is just, I really can't get my head around what the world would look like if you lose 96% of the species on it. Okay, that's mainly marine, but we know it affected the plants. We know it affected the terrestrial animals. To think that we're losing, 96% of the species in a geological instant is just mind-boggling. And of course, there's the other one, is the end Cretaceous, because it is the most, I guess, the most popular mass mm-hmm. extinction. It's where we lose all the dinosaurs that walked on land. Massive changes in the oceans, although the extinction rate there is probably 60 to 70% rather than the huge numbers at the mass of at the end of the Permian.
And what are some of the reasons that can lead to mass extinctions?
Before I do that, can I, because it's easy to explain them if we look at a bit broader.
Sure.
The other thing that runs through the book is this notion of an Earth system, and it's a way of looking at the planet as a whole. So we're looking at its mechanics of keeping us alive. It's our life support system, and what it means is that we can divide the planet up into different sorts of reservoirs. We can look at the Earth beneath our feet. We can look at the atmosphere, we can look at the oceans, and we can look at the biosphere. And all of those interact to maintain climate at about the level that we are, that can support life. And that's been happening since the end of the Cambrian, 500, 600 million years ago, from the beginning of the Cambrian, rather. And each mass extinction seems to be associated with pushing that Earth system out of equilibrium. And there's a number of ways that's happened. In the case of the end Permian, it's forced into another equilibrium point, which is unsuitable for life, and the biosphere collapses through to what is now generally acknowledged to be a major volcanic eruption. It's called the Siberian Traps, and the numbers there are astronomical. The amount of lava and eruption that went on was huge. Huge amounts of CO2 into the atmosphere, the temperature goes up, and the atmosphere was already very high in CO2 because of the way the continents were arranged, and it didn't have the geographic distribution we have today that would remove the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. We didn't have many tropical tropical weathering going on. Mm. So the atmosphere, CO2 was already high, the temperatures were high, and suddenly you push into the atmosphere enormous amounts of CO2 so that the climate gets very, very warm very fast. The oceans become acidic because you're absorbing CO2 into them. It's become more anoxic. And on top of that, it's quite likely that these things called clathrates melted. Melted clathrates release methane, and methane's a very, very powerful greenhouse gas. So the whole thing would be cycled through. Clathrates are around today, they're on the deep parts of the ocean. And as long as it stays cold and under high pressure, they don't melt, but increase the temperature and they will. And this triggers a shift in the Earth system's equilibrium, and the whole system just collapses in on itself. And it takes a while for the system to come back as all the various components start working together to produce the equitable climate for life. And it's similar at the end of the Cretaceous. We have another major eruption, the Deccan Traps in India. Again, massive eruption, huge amounts of CO2 in the atmosphere. So the climate was probably difficult. And then on top of that, you have this meteorite hitting at exactly the right time and pushing everything into extinction. So it's easy to say that all mass extinctions are caused by a shift in the equilibrium point of the system, but it's what triggers that shift that we're looking at. And I'll be honest, I think it's terrifying to think that when you look back on what happened at the end of the Permian with a high CO2, organic, anoxic oceans, acidic oceans, it sounds very much like what's happening today. And we really don't need want to go down that path.
So essentially, this disturbance in the equilibrium can be brought about by different events, but the end result is kind of the same, which...
Exactly. We're looking at a trigger for pushing this forcing that pushes the system out of equilibrium. And I'd have to say we're not doing a good job of avoiding it at the moment.
So does this also include the timeline where this equilibrium is disturbed? For example, during very fast changes, the life cannot adapt.
That's probably true. We look at there's a point called the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum where the temperature suddenly rocketed up 4 degrees. No one's quite sure why it happened. It's probably something to do with permafrost melting, releasing methane. But at that point, it's very fast. It's a very rapid change. It didn't result in a mass extinction, although there are extinctions involved with it. But what it did do was change things like the distribution of animals. The tropical belts expanded. So all those animals managed to track the changes. It's only when it becomes too fast and too far that these animals can't do it, and the equilibrium shifts and we have mass extinction.
And how does the world look after the mass extinction? What do we know from the history?
That's what I was saying earlier. I really can't imagine a world where you're looking at say the end of the Permian, 96% of animals and plants just disappearing. I mean, I've seen pictures of people trying to illustrate it, and one of them was a fully functioning reef before the extinction event, and then after the extinction event, there's this sandy bottom with a couple of shells and maybe a fish swimming over it, and on land there's they had a picture of rotting vegetation that had died during the extinction event, with these animals crawling all over them, looking very despondent, I'd have to say. So I just can't imagine it. I really can't see in my head what you look at a tropical reef today, and it's full of biodiversity. It's full of animals living in the crevices, corals, and yet all the reefs were wiped out at the end of the Permian, and they didn't come back for 20 million years. I just find that extraordinary. And as I said, I have no idea Well, I can imagine it, but it's really horrific.
20 million years. So does it take that long for the life to reinstall itself?
Not necessarily all life, but certainly the reefs did. The reefs, in the late Permian, the reefs were dominated by two fossil groups, coral groups, tabulates and rugosa corals, and they just wiped out. And it took 20 million years for a new group, the scleractinians, to evolve. Other times it's faster. I think there is evidence that following the end of the Cretaceous, it's about a million years to come back online. But you've got to remember that in terms of a human time span, a million years is an enormous length of time. I mean, I say somewhere in the book that one of the things I do is try to teach first years what I mean by geological or deep time, and trying to get over to people what a million years looks like or feels like or whatever is just so difficult. It's more time than, I don't know, it's hard to describe. I mean, the pyramids are 4,000-5,000 years old, but that's only a fraction of the time it takes for a million years to elapse. So, yeah, geologically, we can say it was quick. It took a million years, but in human time frame, that's a long time.
Well, this brings us to the joyous situation nowadays. So what is going on?
I think one of the things I'm trying to do in the book is to set the modern biodiversity crisis into a historical setting. And I don't like the term sixth extinction. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One is, it's probably the most trivial reason, is we've had more than five. We've had 19 or whatever, however you count them. So the six is not right, but it's a nice, catchy, sort of easy to grasp idea. But more than that, it links it too strongly with the previous mass extinctions, and it sort of abrogates our own responsibility for it. We are undoubtedly entering a mass extinction. The rates at which things are going extinct have lifted enormously since humans have been on the planet. We are, as I said, it's quite terrifying to think that some of the things we're doing sounds exactly like what happened at the end of the Permian. But I don't think everything's lost. I hope that the book is at least at the end positive, and say we have time, not a lot, but we have a little bit of time to reverse the situation. And the book's been reviewed lots of times, and mostly positively. But this one critic said, you know, it's nice, but he doesn't give any solutions to what's going on. But since the book was published, there's been a couple of papers I've come across that really do outline what we need to do to avoid pushing the Earth system out of its equilibrium point, or at least not too far out of its equilibrium point. First up, the last IPCC report indicates that we've gone too far to simply return to where we were. And what we have to do is to stabilize the planet in its current conditions. And the way we do that is to reduce emissions. That's undoubtedly a key factor. We have to make sure that everything that is carbon is getting locked up in, like the Northern Hemisphere forests are a great source, sink of carbon. They've got to be preserved. And then areas that have been degraded, we have to bring back onto a better footing than they are now. And it doesn't take much of those. It only needs about, some modeling suggests, 30% of the badly affected areas that we've cleared and damaged. If we can repair those, then we'll be on the way to actually avoiding slipping into a shift in your equilibrium point. And it's not easy, but I think the fossil record shows what happens if we don't do it. We're looking at a very significant extinction event. The fossil record also shows that if we do that, we can bring it back. We can shift things back towards a more even equilibrium point than we are dealing with at the moment.
I suppose we don't really have 1 million years to spare for waiting for them to return.
We don't. And there's some numbers I quote in the book, which are estimates by a group who looked at what would happen if we just didn't do anything, and then what would happen if we did something about it. And they were looking at the extinctions of vertebrate fossils or vertebrate animals. And their estimates were that if we didn't do anything, we would slip to a 75% extinction rate in about 270 years. Mm-hmm. But if we did something about it and we stopped those extinctions happening, then that extinction rate pushes out to sometimes thousands of years. So I think the thing we've got to look at is those numbers are probably, well, they were done in the late 80s, so they probably could be revised nowadays. But what it shows is, okay, we've got a little bit of time if we don't do anything right away, but we get much more time if we act. And I guess that's what ultimately the story of the book is. You've got to, if we act and actually try to pull back on the extinctions that are happening all around us, we will do something. We must preserve the biodiversity of this planet. It's a key factor in the Earth system is the biosphere, and we must protect that at all costs. So I don't know what's happening elsewhere in the world, but in New Zealand there's a lot of people offsetting their carbon if they fly by planting pine trees. Well, it's very good for a point, but there isn't biodiversity, and that's a monospecific area. What we need is proper diversity with functioning ecosystems that allow the operation of the Earth system.
So scientists do these predictive models, and how accurate are they? Are they based on some of the data from previous extinctions?
I'm in no means an expert on the modelling. I know that I work with people who model Antarctic ice sheets, for example. I know that they spend a lot of time making sure that their data fits with geological time and what's happening in the geological past. With the ones I'm talking about, they've actually looked at the rate at which fossils have gone extinct since humans have been on the planet and projecting those into the future. That's more or less how a lot of those figures were come up with. Things like the rate of extinctions are based on things that have happened over the last 10,000, 15,000 years. When they're projecting into the future, these are slightly different techniques. They actually work out the rate that things are going extinct now and project that into the future. But they do require a fair bit of work from the fossil record. It's not easy stuff. I mean, we don't have a great record of the last 10,000 years, but it's all we have.
So in general, we tend to focus on this sort of eccentric megafauna and big fossils. So how important for us to think about extinction of, say, insects and smaller critters?
I think that's absolutely imperative. We tend to, I mean, when you talk to someone about mass extinctions, they all want to talk about dinosaurs. But in fact, it's things like insects and fungi and plants that maintain that ecosystem, that maintain the biodiversity, that allows the Earth system to operate fully. you know, you could probably survive without dinosaurs, but you probably couldn't survive without insects. Mm. So I think it's quite obvious. You know, let me go back. It's quite understandable that people want to look at dinosaur extinctions that are big and they're charismatic, but you mustn't lose track of the fact that we're looking at a whole ecosystem that's wiped out in these mass extinctions, not just dinosaurs or flying reptiles, and they are vitally important. I mean, I think it's become increasingly obvious that insects of all things are absolutely imperative to maintaining an ecosystem in balance.
This is so interesting, especially when you think that even today, if we lose some of the insect species, that could mean completely disastrous consequences for humans, like bees, for example.
Bees are an obvious one. I mean, we're in New Zealand are encouraging now to plant plants that will flower and attract bees, because we need bees to pollinate and to transfer the pollen around the place. There's no part of the ecosystem that I can think of that we could really easily do without. It is a whole that integrates and works together. And we just can't afford to lose a significant portion of it. But I think insects are really underestimated. And we know that a lot of them, that there is good evidence that we lost a lot of insects at the end of the Permian.
Is it easy to estimate the losses of insects, so for example, compared to the bigger animals of whose bones we can find?
Yes. Again, we come back to the limitations of the fossil record. It's easier to collect bones than it is to collect insects, although there have been some really good efforts at documenting insect diversity through time. And in one of the earlier incarnations of the book, I actually reproduced diagrams showing the differences between insects and plants through time, and they have mass extinctions at the same time as all the other groups. But yeah, it's much harder, because they're just not as easy to preserve. In fact, plants probably have a better record than insects, because spores and pollen are very easy to preserve. They're made of a substance that is extremely unreactive and easily to preserve. As I said, we get them out of the rock by dissolving the rock in hideous acids. So it's odd, but we can have a good record of plant material, but we don't have a good record of insects.
So one of the arguments that is often made nowadays is, apart from just prevention of the change in a climate, we can think about mitigation, for example, de-extinction, and bringing all of these species that we lost sometime in the future. And we have even the banks that store, you know, the cells and reproductive cells as well, even somatic cells of different species. So what do you think about that?
I may be a little of a heretic in this situation. I think de-extinction is something we can't afford. I think we have far more pressing problems than bringing back mammoths. And they wouldn't be mammoths anyway. There would be some sort of hybrid between whatever mammoth genes we can recover and whatever we want to put them in. I think, as a paleontologist, there is nothing I'd like to see more than a mammoth striding across the steppes of Russia or somewhere like that. But I think there are far more pressing problems, and I'm not sure bringing mammoths or dinosaurs back to life would solve our problems. I'd much rather see us put effort and time into preserving what we already have, rather than bringing these things, at least in some form, back. As I said, it's not a particular popular viewpoint. I've got some people I've got some friends who are very keen on the idea, but I think it's a luxury that we can't afford.
So what is the importance of bringing the public into this discussion and even raising the awareness of people about the rates of at which we're losing our species now?
This is the reason I wrote the book. The book is not a scientific treatise, or it's not a textbook. It's a book that I hope the general public can read and understand. I think the more we can inform the public, the more they understand the situation they're in and possibly ways out of it, then the more pressure they can put on governments and industries to do something. I think if they don't understand or they don't believe, then it's there's no reason for governments or industry in particular to shift. Mm. So as I said, the reason that I think I aimed the book where I did is to inform the public, because I think an informed public is the key to bringing things into focus and forcing change onto government. Without that, I get very down on the whole situation.
And where do you want to see us head into the future?
It's a good question. Well, first up, we have to meet the Paris Accord. I don't think there's any choice about that at all. But on top of that, we then have to start thinking about how we can. We've shifted the planet a little bit in its equilibrium. We have to stabilize it where it is. Bringing the emissions down to the Paris Accord is one thing. Preserving the biodiversity we have is the second thing. And once we've done that, then perhaps we will maintain the situation we're in. We don't want to go any further into disequilibrium, because we don't want to heat the planet up too far at all. It's not going to be an easy job. And I, as I said, there are times when I sit and think, you know, is it possible? But I think if we all give up, it'd be really quite a difficult situation. I think there's a lot of entrenched opinions and beliefs out there that need to change, particularly among industries who are either dodging the changes they have to make or ignoring them. And a lot of governments aren't doing what they need to do. I'm actually Australian. I was educated in Australia, and I was delighted at the last Australian election, if I'm allowed to get a little political on this thing, where the two dominant parties have been almost eclipsed by a group that they're calling teal candidates that reflect what the public are saying about climate change and the need for action. And they're going to hold quite a lot of sway in the government. And I think that is just amazingly good. And I hope that sort of trend can continue around the world, that governments will shift, probably due to public pressure, to start really acting on the promises they made in Paris and since then.
So then you're quite optimistic that we will be able to come together sort of on a global scale.
At 3 o'clock in the morning, sometimes I'm not that optimistic, but I think if you're not optimistic, you don't want to give up on this thing. It's the planet's too beautiful a place to just say, no, we're going to give up and just live for God knows how many years before we find the place uninhabitable. I don't think we can give up. I think the human race tends to be flexible enough in the end that we can actually make the changes. It's just we're slow at doing it. Mm. And the slower we are, the more difficult it is, the bigger the changes we're going to have to make to overcome the situation. And I think that's really the crux of the problem. We've got to act more rapidly than we're doing now.
And what discoveries in your research and your journey in writing your book Extinction surprised you the most?
I think of all the things that surprised me in there was actually looking at the red list of extinctions. And this really cemented this idea that we're not looking at the sixth extinction. The Red List is an amazing piece of documentation that scientists are putting together that really does look at animals that are extinct and the rate at which they're going extinct. And I expected enormous numbers. 50% extinctions, 20% extinction, and none of them came out at that level. I think mammals, this is stuff I did in 2020, mammals are running at about 1.5% of currently known species have gone extinct. Insects, just over 0.5% of species have gone extinct. So we haven't killed off enormous numbers of animals yet, but the rate at which they're going extinct, judging from what we're getting from the fossil record, is high. So we've succeeded in causing extinctions to a large number, but not a devastating number yet. That I guess that's what's giving me the hope that we can turn this thing around. But the rate at which they're going extinct is increasing, and that's what we have to pull back on. And when we do that, then we get more time to actually fix the whole situation.
The way you put it, we haven't yet killed off. It's quite visceral.
We're often very polite when we talk about extinctions, but we're killing them off. One of my saddest pictures I've seen is a picture of a thylacine, which is an Australian marsupial wolf, pacing the cage in a zoo in Hobart, and it's the last thylacine that ever existed, and it died probably through neglect at the zoo, actually, at least that's the rumour, and that's it. That species has gone. It's been killed off, and it was killed off not because that one species, that one individual died, but because farmers were worried that it was killing their sheep, so they were shooting them. The last thylacine died in the wild well before then. And that's inescapably sad to see this amazing animal stalking the cage, knowing that's it, that's the last thylacine on the planet, and it didn't last much longer. And I just don't want to see that again. We can rattle off others. The passenger pigeon was the same, the dodo. I just don't want any more animals to go extinct if we can avoid it.
And then on maybe a slightly upbeat note, so do you have any favorite extinct animals that were really cool?
so many. We're actually putting together a public talk here called The Time Traveler's Guide to Not Being Eaten. And we're looking at apex predators through time. And I've got a review. It's for children. And we were going to look at the Tyrannosaurus rex, but that's a bit blasé. So I'm actually doing the Deinonychus, which I think is a lovely critter. If you've seen Jurassic Park, the animal they call Velociraptor there isn't Velociraptor, because Velociraptor is about the size of a turkey. Deinonychus is, that's a Deinonychus, and they're smart and whatnot. But the reason I like them so much at the moment is the current reconstructions puts feathers all over them. So you've got this feathered dinosaur, and I think that's just a fantastic image. But if I had to name my favorite fossil on the planet, it's Archaeopteryx, the bird from Solnhofen and limestone. I think that's just absolutely beautiful. And the Berlin specimen, which is complete and has the head attached, which the London specimen doesn't, is just stunningly beautiful with its feathers and this halfway house between therapsid dinosaurs, not therapsid, dinosaurs and birds. It's just beautiful.
Yeah, and the recent findings about the feathers and their colors as well, it just really puts you in a different world.
It is. This is one of those things about paleontology is it constantly amazes me, and I think being stuck on fossil algae, maybe I don't get quite as involved, but imagine how the imagination it took to try and work out how to pick the colors of feathers. And they're doing it quite regularly now. And I think it's just astounding. I think it's lovely.
Well, this has been a truly fascinating and insightful discussion. So what are you focusing on now? And what will be your next project?
As I said, I had this major project with colleagues in the Netherlands at Utrecht University. That's been going on for far too long. But so that's the microscope work. Beyond that, I've got, and that's quite recent. That's last couple of 100,000 years. But there's a section of rock in Australia we want to look at again, and that's looks across the Eocene-Oligocene boundary about 30 odd million years ago. And it's an important boundary in that it's when the ice sheets formed in Antarctica, for permanent ice sheets for the last time. So we were a bit stuck where we couldn't get over to sample it ourselves, so because of the pandemic. But that lifting, we may go over and resample the section and look at the microfossils in there. And that's a really lovely section to work on.
Yeah, I actually got a question. Maybe it's a little bit off topic, but I was always wondering about Antarctica. So there is a ground underneath, isn't it? Is it below the ocean level or above? Or
Antarctica splits into two parts. If you look at a map, it's hard to do without pictures, but there's a mountain range that runs across almost the entire continent called the Transantarctic Mountains. Now, if you look with Greenwich up, to the west of the Transantarctic Mountains is a thing called the West Antarctic Ice Sheet. And that is that's grounded below sea level, so that if it lifts, water, there's water underneath it. On the other side is the big ice sheet, that's the East Antarctic Ice Sheet, and that's 4 kilometers, 4.5 kilometers thick. And that's much more stable in the west. I was sitting having a beer with a very, very good Antarctic ice sheet modeler, and he was talking away to someone else, and he just happened to say, "Oh, and the current climate, the West Antarctic sheet is cactus; it's gone, and he's got no hope of it surviving." And that's largely because it's not resting on it; it is seated below sea level, whereas the other one isn't. And if that melts, we're looking at, I think, 5 meters of sea level rise. So not looking forward to that one.
Oh, we cannot afford 5 meters.
No, you don't want the other one to go because it's nearly 60.
And then, is it possible to find any fossils in Antarctica?
Not in the ice. Oh, well, that's not true. You get a few fossils in the ice. But the projects I've been involved with actually drilled through the ice. And then in ones I've been involved with, the ice is floating on the sea. And then it's about, you know, several hundred meters of water depth, and they drill into the sediment underneath it. And this, the fossils I look at come from those sedimentary layers underneath the ocean. And I've been lucky enough to go down and actually collect the samples for study and actually study them down there too. Took my microscope with me.
Oh, wow. Maybe that's your next book.
Yeah, I don't know. I'd write another book on. There's a chapter in the current book on the megafauna extinctions, the ones that happened between 50 and 10,000 years ago, the mammoths and the saber-toothed cats and stuff like that. And it's very complicated and changing all the time. And I've often wondered if that couldn't be expanded into another book as well.
Mm. And what would be the best way for our listeners to find more information about your work and also your book?
My work, I guess it's the best way would be to look at my university's website. I think I'm still on there. The book is available throughout Amazon Book Depository, Cambridge Books sell it. It's available both as a electronic and hard copy. If you're living in New Zealand, we'll be at the Auckland Writers Festival in August giving a talk, and hopefully the book will be available there.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you very much. It's been enjoyable.